Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm Bob Dumel, your host for The Buzz on Technical Rescue. Today's show, we're going to look into specialized equipment is carried by urban search and rescue teams. Today, my guest is going to be Mike Daly. Mike's a lieutenant out of the Monroe Township, New Jersey Fire Department. He's also a training officer there. Mike's involved as an instructor at Middlesex County Fire Academy, where he's responsible for rescue training curriculum development. Mike also has a number of degrees, one in business management and another in public safety administration. Mike is a member of the New Jersey Urban Search and Rescue Task Force 1, where he holds a position as rescue officer. Also a managing member of Fire Service Performance Concepts. Mike is an ongoing contributor to Firehouse.com and will be a presenter this year at Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland, being held this coming July 20th through 25th. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today. How are you doing?
Doing good, Bob. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Many reports of successful rescues are being accomplished, just continue to flow in from Haiti, many of which are related to the USAR teams currently working there. We thought it would be a good time to talk about the specialized equipment that these USAR teams are using when they respond to these incidents. We're also going to touch on a little bit of the equipment used in other types of disasters so people don't think the USAR teams are specific to an earthquake or a hurricane, but that they really cover a much broader level of capabilities. Once again, thanks for joining me today, and let's start out a little bit of an overview on a team's cache. Mike, if you could just start out by kind of telling the listeners a little bit about just the volume or the magnitude of cache of equipment that a USAR team would bring to an incident.
Well, New Jersey Task Force 1 is very well equipped. We follow the FEMA guidelines when it comes to responding equipment. We have three tractor trailers fully stocked with rescue equipment, ranging from extrication equipment to gasoline-powered saws, hydraulic-powered tools, electric-powered tools, air pneumatic-powered tools, you name it. We carry just about everything that you would see to perform any type of technical rescue in those tractor trailers. We also have a communications unit that follows us along and provides us with communication capabilities to talk to just about anybody when we get on scene. We also have a swift water unit that has a fully stocked tool cache and vehicle and watercraft cache for response. These guys had actually spent a few weeks down in Louisiana during Hurricane Katrina as well.
So it's a pretty heavy load when we start talking about transporting this. I know one of the articles I was reading this morning prior to getting together with you, they were talking about USAR teams bringing three tractor trailer fulls of equipment to the situation in Haiti. So we start to look at the logistical side of things. Just transportation alone, the aircraft needed, the size of the aircraft to get the materials transported. And then at our FEMA level teams being air mobile, having to have the palletization and the means to move this large volume of equipment creates another whole challenge for the folks who take care of the operations themselves, primarily the logistics members of the teams. Your logistics folks, what are some of the specialties that they bring to the table? We always talk about the rescuers making the rescues and things of that nature, but sometimes it's those folks that are somewhat behind the scenes that are really the core to keeping a mission going forward. What types of things would they be bringing to the table that keeps you as the rescuer up front moving forward?
Well, our logistics guys are top rate. We have a logistics leader who is just aces. He can move anything just about anywhere at any time. We do have the capabilities of traveling pretty much anywhere over the road. One of the things that our logistics people did was reached out to qualified drivers and operators for equipment. I'm actually one of the drivers on the team as well for the tractor trailers if need be, although I'm not assigned to logistics, I'm in rescue. We also are located in a military base in Ocean County, New Jersey, And if we needed to be airborne, I believe there is a plan, a logistical plan, to get us on some military aircraft to get us where we need to go. And these guys can move us quick and efficiently like I've never seen before. It's actually quite an impressive operation to watch these guys do this. To me, as a rescuer who doesn't have a very strong background in logistics, I would look at it as organized chaos, but it's amazing how they can put this thing together with the minimum amount of people that they use and how efficient they do it.
And that term, organized chaos, definitely comes into play quite often. The other thing we hear a lot of references to is the old TV show MASH. You need to have a Radar O'Reilly in your logistics unit, somebody who can reach out and make something happen that never existed before. And these are the backbone of it when we get into our equipment. We talked a little bit about the Jersey team being a state-level resource, and traditionally same coming from state-level background here in New York. We're traditionally an over-the-road type of operation where we get into our FEMA teams. They're both over-the-road and airborne capable. We start looking at just the weight of the equipment being transported, the different materials. Many times at the state level, we'll have an entire tractor-trailer load of lumber that travels along with us. These are the type of things that aren't as easily transported on an aircraft just because of the size and the weight that they bring to the table. So we can see is the further we reach away from our home ports, the more difficult to get the needed supplies it's going to be.
Yeah, we have a tractor trailer for lumber as well. Not to mention that when we get away from home port and we have to fly, we have to travel empty, no fuel, which becomes a logistical nightmare to get fuel when the infrastructure of a place is damaged and they're having a hard enough time getting it as well.
But that's a key point. We possess much equipment that is dependent upon different types of fuels for its function. And when you do travel outside of the area, and this can even be in a local incident where the infrastructure has sustained significant damage because of the event itself, something we take for granted at home, reaching out, filling the tank, and refueling the equipment becomes another challenge. And many times the delays in a response or an operational capability is hinged on that alone, because they do arrive fuelless and then have to acquire it. Not always an easy activity, especially when you're leaving the country, going into different areas. The political ramifications of how things are being dealt with can bring quite a bit to the table. When you travel, going into the different types of tools, that's being said about how they're handling, you know, we'll use the earthquake in Haiti as our opening point here. You know, the first thing they need to do is get in and start searching. Can you kind of touch on any of the specific search tools that you carry within your team that are going to be key elements in this success?
Well, one of the things that we deploy first is the search component goes out with hazmat after we've after the hazmat folks have made the scene safe or secured the scene for safety. The search components go out with the dogs and some of their search cams, and actually go out with a few devices that can actually pick up the slightest sound and even the heartbeat of a patient, a viable patient still in the area under the rubble. They go out and they find a couple of hits, and if they confirm them, then we go out. So a lot of the focus is on the rescuers doing the actual carrying the victims out. And I was watching the news this morning. You see a lot of the teams carrying the survivors out. And I believe the New York team has been credited with about half a dozen successful rescues so far down in Haiti. But what they don't see is what it takes to find the victim. And the search component are the ones that actually go out, get the hits with the dogs, confirm the hits, follow it up with the with that state-of-the-art equipment like the cameras and the analyzers to actually confirm the victim. So that's the tough part, I think, that they have to find the area to start. And with a debris pile of that magnitude, I mean, finding the right place to start is really based on what the search people tell us.
Yeah, very true. Without basically good intel, our search teams and rescue teams can't really move forward. It would be a very time-consuming and non-productive effort. If it wasn't for all the efforts of our advanced group who go out, you mentioned hazmat as being a component of that. Maybe we touch a little bit on some folks listening may be thinking of hazmat in the traditional mode, an industrial accident, things of that nature, but kind of touch a little on what our hazmat folks bring to the table when we travel in a USAR format.
our hazmat guys can pretty much determine the toxicity or the danger level of just about anything. One of the hazmat guys that we had with us when we deployed to the Tropicana, we had a parking deck collapse in 2003 that killed four people. We were still looking for one person, and our hazmat people actually found a puddle of what looked initially like hydraulic fluid, and probably the rescue teams walked past it half a dozen times and didn't think anything of it. With all the dynamic events going on in the arena, it was safe to assume that this was indeed hydraulic fluid, but one of the hazmat people who was carrying hydrogen peroxide with them actually tested the material and saw that it started to bubble, and which led us to believe that that wasn't hydraulic fluid, that was actually blood. And in that area was where we had found that last victim. So we think about all these rad meters and four gas meters and colorimetric tubes and all these devices to find hazardous materials, but it's really I think what the hazmat guys bring is that flexibility and that capability to think, but on all levels and be dynamic and be able to find things like that I would take for granted, where my focus in hazmat is more of the technical device to look for things. These guys, are right on the ball with that kind of stuff.
And that's just another example how urban search and rescue is multifaceted. Many different people make up a 72-person team, all bringing something special to the table, from the top command level down to the youngest rescue member of the team and everything in between. There's a lot of activities that are being covered there. In essence, sometimes one team traveling is covering what an entire department back home would take care of. So it's a very self-sustained type of operation. Going back to our equipment, you have to rely on what you have. You can't go on assumptions that the big box store around the corner and you can't find replacements for things. So by taking care of what you have when you're there with a good logistics team is another factor in keeping this up and running. So with our specialized search equipment, we come to a point where we've made some indications that there could possibly be a victim in this location. Now the real physical work potentially begins, especially we're dealing with concrete type structures, heavy construction, the breaching and breaking tools that need to be brought into the scene. Why don't we go a little bit into that, Mike, and some of the things you've experienced as a rescuer that these teams have brought, or excuse me, these tools have benefited you with?
Well, one of the things that we usually start with is a hammer drill or a core drill, depending on the material we're dealing with. We'll actually get a shot through the slab or whatever material we're cutting through. We'll get a hole big enough that the camera can take a better look, a clearer look in the void space. And once the camera's confirmed the victim location, we'll actually start to make the opening. Now, depending on the position of the victim, there's a lot of different things we can do. You can blow through in a dirty breach, or we can remove a slab as a clean breach. It would depend. We bring, after the drill, comes in the hydraulic and the electric powered breakers. And we usually run multiple tools at the same time so we can get into the space as quick as possible. Now, a lot of the tools that support that operation are the simple ones, the hand pump water cans to keep the dust down while we're cutting concrete, the repair kits, the field repair kits that we can do. Now, logistics takes care of anything that doesn't run, start, break, cut, whatever. But when you have a breaker out in the middle of a pile and you're in a pile a couple acres wide, you can't just walk back to the truck and grab another one very simply. So even the basic hand tools, the repair kits that we keep for the saws and the breakers that we can make the field repair while we're on a pile, we have to keep with us as well. Then there's the support equipment, the generators, getting the generators out there for the power so that we're not running a mile of cable. Getting the water lines out to the area of the pile to run the hydraulic tools while we're running. There's a lot of stuff that goes along with the breaking and the breaching hammers and the chisels. So, and the saws and the extra blades for the saws while we're cutting, taking step cuts for a clean breach. All that stuff has to get supported by other equipment. Everybody sees the big breakers, and that tends to get a lot of the focus because that's where a lot of the work goes, but it's the smaller tools that have to support that as well. Even the hand tools, when we get into shoring, speed squares and hammers and just tool pouches, tape measures, you know, the thing, one running joke that we have on our team is we consider our tape measures the holy grail. It's like one of those things you can never find when you need it, and abundantly, we have an abundance of tape measures. Logistics guys keep us very well stocked. It's just that's just one of those things that once you get a hold of on the pile that you just never let go of.
Yeah, very true. It's sometimes the smallest piece of the puzzle that can bring you to a standstill if you don't have it handy when it's needed to be able to work forward. A little bit earlier, you were talking about doing a borehole and then putting a search cam down into it. Looking at the big picture now, we're very fortunate in today's society to be in a technology growth curve where many of the tools we've used for a number of years in the rescue service are experiencing advancements and innovations. The search cam itself, a new generation will be coming out to the field very soon. It brings many more features to it that it opens up our capabilities. So as a rescuer, we're very fortunate that we work in a very small niche market as far as the availability of equipment we have to do the jobs. But the equipment that's there is constantly being improved upon, and the advancements definitely pay dividends down to the worker who's able to accomplish the task both quicker and many times, the more important part, much safer, both for the rescuers and for the victims we're looking to assist. You talked also about getting into shoring and needing the tools, and it's very true that many times the rescuer going in looks like the neighborhood carpenter who may be putting a new roof on your house when he walks in with a tool belt and various traditional carpentry tools. But when we look at shoring, in essence, it is an offshoot of that industry. Types of shores we use have been used for many years. With your team, what type of materials and what type of shoring would you do in a situation like this to affect a rescue? Say you did get a hit on a potential victim in a structure. Kind of talk a little bit about how or what equipment you would use to shore your way into this position.
Well, one of the things that we carry with us first in is a couple of sets of quick T-type shores with a sole plate, a header, and maybe a pneumatic Paratec or an Airshore strut that we can throw in place quick to kind of get the ball rolling, to get us a safe area to work where we can actually start to operate. The Paratec or the air struts, and I refer to them as pneumatic struts, although we don't use air when we deploy them. We just put them up by hand so we can capture the load and not allow the load to come to fall any further. We will actually build our shoring around these pneumatic struts so that once our shoring is in place, we'll throw either a dead shore or a, if it's a slope floor, we'll have to throw a slope floor or a raker shore, whatever it is we need to throw, but we'll start out with the Paratecs first and build around them. The Paratec assemblies go together relatively quick. We can put them in place quick, and they're very strong. Some of the manufacturers actually make raker triangular shoring systems that we can put in place for leaning walls. We can build wood raker shores around them and then actually take our equipment and put them back and deploy them somewhere else. So the nice thing about that is it goes up quick. We can build around it, and we can redeploy it as we move further into the space. The other thing it has to be, obviously, is the strength. So the amount of wood that we would use and the size of the wood based on the type of the materials we're shoring. Obviously, each type of material has a different weight variation to it, whether it was an ordinary building, which might only be 100 to 150 pounds per square foot, where you're dealing with massive concrete and steel, which could be upwards of 500 pounds per cubic foot. So really, it's going to depend on what it is we're shoring. So there's a lot of different equipment we're going to have to carry with us and a lot of different weighted wood that we're going to have to carry with us to put in place as well. So a lot of that has to get thought about before we get in there. The other thing, too, is do we really need to shore it? We do have options of avoiding it if you can. If we have to work in the area, maybe shoring it. If you can't shore it, you might even have to think about removing it. One of the problems we had at the Tropicana collapse was we had some multi-story freestanding wall supports that were upwards of 12 stories in the air. You can't shore that. You can't remove it because removing it would cause a lot further damage to the area that we were working in to try to find victims. So in that case, we had no other choice but just to work around it and avoid it. And that was a pretty precarious situation. We had one safety squad just keeping an eye on any movement on these wall supports in the event that they started to lean in one direction. we would have to reevaluate our position and then maybe take an attack from a different area.
Well, and, you know, and that's a key point that, and going right back into the format of our teams, our structural specialists that we have with us, many times these are individuals not from the traditional fire service, but they could be an actual engineer in their primary career field. But these people come to the events with us as parts of our team or as additional resources from our overhead, our FEMA support mechanism, and various different agencies such as the Corps of Engineers. These people bring a wealth of knowledge, which helps create a safe haven for us to work in, which in the long run benefits the victims we're going for. So there again, it's the picture, as soon as you look at one little snapshot of it, it really starts to expand when you look at all the different components that are required to make that a successful operation.
It's actually a humbling experience to watch your first full-blown operation. I don't know how you felt when you first started, Bob, but on my first deployment, when I watched this this event go through its steps, and when it was all said and done, it's a humbling experience where you would think that mobilizing this many resources in this fashion would be a lot harder than it is. But it's only through the work of a lot of the professionals that we have on our team that work behind the scenes to make that logistical problem run as smooth as it does.
Yeah, very true, Mike. I mean, a lot of times we use the cliches, you know, it's a team sport, it takes a group, so on and so forth. However, when you get into an event of this magnitude, it definitely proves that more than just a catchphrase, but that's a reality. If it isn't for the efforts of the group, there won't be a successful outcome. You know, and we've talked a little bit about the specialty tools we bring, but there's more to bringing a team on scene than just the hand tools. When we look at a team's cache of equipment, there's another whole phase of it that also sometimes sits in the background. If you're going to deploy for a period of time to a different location from home, you know, something as basic as having proper housing, tents, and different type of creature comforts to sustain the member's operation. A command center or a base of operations, a BOO as it would be referred to, things of that nature to support it and to support the troops out working in the field, in our case, our rescue specialists. What are some of the things within your team and more of the backside of the operation that you bring to an event that helps make it overall a successful operation?
Well, from the administrative end, the administrators have their BOO, their base of operations, set up through their tents. They have large-scale tents that they can set up so they can run their command operations. There's logistics tents that they can set up for equipment and keep equipment moving in and out, a section for maintenance. We are pretty much self-sustainable for the first 72 hours of the incident. We bring enough tents and portable housing that we sit, I think, between 3 and 6 deep in a tent. And obviously you have to hot cot it every once in a while. When one team is out on a deployment, the other team gets some rest. So you're sharing 6 guys sometimes in a tent. But we do have enough capabilities to keep everybody out of the elements as best as we can. We also bring all the medical component people bring their material that they need, medicines and first aid equipment for the rescuers, along with for the victims, and they bring that equipment as well as the hygiene end of what is needed when we get out there. You get 200 some odd people working, and you start feeding them and keeping them hydrated. They're going to need a place to keep clean as well. We have portable relief stations, if you will, for lack of a better word, that we bring with us so we can collect it and we dispose of it right. So that's going to become problematic in a large-scale event such as what's going on in Haiti, because fresh water and materials for such is going to be in high demand. It's going to be hard to find. So for the first 3 days or so, we bring a lot of that stuff with us as well. But it does have to get replaced after a while.
And this is the type of situation where, you know, operating in a disaster-stricken area, you know, all of the work you want to do becomes even more challenging. One of the things I noticed a few years ago, a business partner and I were traveling to England to review an exercise there, and their deployable team, which does an international type of coverage around the world, their cutting station was much different than ours. They had one individual highly trained with a chainsaw. He represented the cutting station. This individual with a single chainsaw, kept extremely sharp, was able to cut wedges, cut lumber at desired lengths. And their whole premise was, when you go into a disaster-stricken area, to having the fuels and all the accessories that you would want on a day-to-day operation may not be available. The same thing was, they have trained to not be codependent on palletized lumber, things of that nature. So we see we all do the same general process, but we vary a little depending on our location, our needs, and the things you've learned through past experiences. You know, there's no better school of learning than through experience itself. I think many of these teams that have been deployed multiple times work to a different level, and it's primarily because they've had the opportunity to hone their skills, per se. Moving away from the earthquake, hurricane type of thing, we talked a little earlier, flood responses. These are the types of things also that a USAR team would be called in to assist with. What type of specialty equipment would you have within your team's cache of equipment for responses to a flood?
Well, we have a full separate equipment cache for our swiftwater guys and girls who deployed for that. There are a couple trailers full of wetsuits, dry suits. There are PFDs. We have inflatable boats. We have a few fast haul boats, and we have a lot of the guys that are dive certified that are on a team as well. So we bring a lot of specialty items as well, just for that deployment alone. That doesn't necessarily require the deployment of a full activation of the USAR team. There's been cases where Swiftwater and logistics have been deployed just in support of the Swiftwater people, and sometimes people in other competencies come in as well, and just to assist in the logistical needs of what the Swiftwater folks need, whether it's help move equipment, whether it's do repairs or maintenance, just provide manpower for what they need. The manpower end alone is probably the most important tool, I think, that we bring with us, is the right people to do the best job in the most efficient way that they can.
It's well put, and a lot of times the resource needed the most are the hands to do the work. As we talk about rotating of teams in and out of any event, many times this equipment will stay behind and a new team will come in as a manpower type of resource to replace those that have worked a full shift or number of days and are due to rotate out. So when we start looking back at our equipment and our logistics people, we can see the value of having, you know, these tools on the ground, but also the secondary value is they continue to function long beyond the time frame that one group of rescuers has come and gone from the event. So just starting to wrap up a little today, Mike, I wanted to thank you for joining me. Hopefully this just kind of shed a little more light on the types of tools and some of the challenges faced by a USAR team when they deploy both domestically and abroad. I hope everyone enjoyed today's session. You can hear more from Mike on firehouse.com. Please check out his current article, Rescue Operations for Trench Collapse Part 1, on firehouse.com. And Mike will also be presenting at this year's Firehouse Expo in Baltimore. So if you have an opportunity to get down there, please check out Mike's activities. This is your host, Bob Dumel. Thank you for listening today, and be safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.